Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, many thanks for coming along tonight to hear our speakers, Dr. James Curran and Professor Stuart Ward. I'll introduce both our speakers briefly. James Curran is Senior Lecturer in History at the University of Sydney, and he is the author of The Power of Speech, Australian Prime Ministers Defining the National Image, and also a former analyst at the Office of National Assessments in Canberra. And Stuart Ward is Professor at the University of Copenhagen, and he is the author of Australia and the British Embrace, The Decline of the Imperial Idea, of the Imperial Ideal, and also the editor of Australia's Empire. And tonight, on the occasion of the publication of The Unknown Nation, Australia After Empire, which our speakers have co-authored, they're going to talk tonight to the Sydney Institute on the topic Nationhood Before Gough Whitlam, Australia in the 1960s. So we're going to start off with Professor Ward, we'll then go to Dr. Curran, then we'll go to questions and discussion. Stuart Ward, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much, Jared. I want to start with the idea that nationalism has had an unusual history in Australia. Here we have an idea that had such a profound influence in 19th and 20th century Europe, and which played such an instrumental role in the politics of decolonisation the world over in the second half of the 20th century, has tended to have an ambivalent resonance here in Australia. The word itself, nationalism, was never entirely at home here. Talk of a national character or a national spirit can certainly be traced all the way back to the colonial era, but nationalism has not been so prominent in our political culture, tainted perhaps as it was with the idea of independence, another term conspicuously absent in the Australian lexicon. Those who waved the banner of nationalism had a tendency to come unstuck, whether it be political nationalists like Jack Lang, or a cultural nationalist like P.R. Stevenson in the 1930s, who wound up locked up as a traitor during the Second World War. The historian Eric Hobsbawm once defined nationalism very simply as the idea that the national and the political unit ought to be congruent. And I think this definition, Hobsbawm's definition, provides a clue as to the discordant resonance of nationalism in Australian political language for the best part of 150 years. Because in Australia, for much of the 19th and 20th centuries, the political unit, the state, whether it be colonial or federal, tended not to function as the conduit of a self-sufficient, self-validating, exclusive cultural nationalism. When Henry Parkes spoke of a crimson thread of kinship that runs through us all, he was not invoking an exclusive Australian ethnicity, a cultural idea that could make sense in its own terms. Parkes was speaking at a time when all of the classic criteria for 19th century nationalism, race, ethnicity, common language, shared history, heritage, community of culture and so forth, tended to promote a wider sense of kinship with the British world. He invoked a global thread of kinship in its Australian setting. Now, this idea of Australians as a British people helped to define the categories of inclusion and exclusion in Australia, who was in and who was out. And in classic nationalist terms, these categories were vigorously, even fiercely, upheld. But these categories also rendered the vocabulary of nationalism somehow dissonant, out of harmony with Australian experience. the historian Keith Hancock defended his concept of independent Australian Britons as something far more honourable, more dignified, and certainly far less dangerous than what he termed the snarling nationalisms of Europe. That somehow in Australia, the idea of nationalism carried this sense of something angry, something potentially destabilising. So, at the level of political and civic culture, the language of empire and Britishness tended to perform the function that nationalism had fulfilled elsewhere, even as the political unit was defined in more narrow, more local terms. Our book, The Unknown Nation, is as fundamentally about what happens to the idea of nationalism in Australia when the superstructure of British imperialism, when the material, strategic, economic props of Britishness are rapidly swept aside in the 1950s and 60s, and Australians find that they have to reorient themselves in a radically reordered world. Because it is here, at this time, that Australian civic culture is faced with something of a dilemma. How to reconstitute the nation in a more self-sufficient, self-validating way. And it's this fundamental problem that gives way to an entire generation of self-reflection, debate, discord, and public hand-wringing about the national civic essence. Here we have an era, the 1960s and into the 1970s, so often regarded in terms of national liberation, so often remembered as a time of new opportunities and new departures, can also be seen in this context as a journey into the unknown. Now, one of the reasons why this problem, the idea of the nation, was so difficult at that time is that the processes that underpinned it, namely the global sweep of decolonisation that swept the European imperial order aside from post-45, and secondly, Britain's hesitant economic and political embrace of Europe, these were processes that Australians had neither sought nor particularly welcomed, certainly not unanimously so. So as a result, they could not fall back on a myth of self-deliverance from the bonds of empire, not in the way that underpinned the post-colonial legitimating myths of places like India, Kenya, Ghana, and so forth. And so this raises a great question mark that is grappled with by an entire generation of politicians, public servants, public intellectuals, artists, filmmakers, anthem composers, flag designers, and all kinds of people. Once you recognise the obsolescence of being British, what next? Now, I want to talk briefly about how this challenge is met rhetorically at the level of political language and some of the ideas that enter into public discourse to fill the void. And then having done so, I'm going to hand over to James, who's going to look at the way in which these ideas filter in to the business of governance, that they filter into the level of policy and the way in which Australian political leaders in the late 1960s and particularly into the 1970s try to forge a new idea of Australia in practice. But firstly, a few ideas. From the late 50s and 1960s, we can see signs of Australian public intellectuals grasping for a new nomenclature, a new way of talking about the collective civic idea. In 1958, Russell Ward published his celebrated Australian Legend, and while he used older established concepts like the national character, ideas that had a robust, deeper resonance, he also looked for new ideas. He talked about the national ethos, the national mystique. Ward was clearly grasping for a new way of making sense of a new Australia. And it's also in the early 1960s that we see the very first appearance of the idea of Australian identity. Now, John Howard recently, talked about this perpetual seminar about our identity of Australia. And certainly, it's an idea that for many people has become very tired and well-worn. And yet, it's not widely understood just how novel a term the national identity is. Unlike terms like national character and nationalism that have a deeper 19th century lineage, and even older in French, in Australia, the idea, well, globally, the idea is only about 50 years old. And Australians, alongside Canadians, are among the pioneers in its usage. Identity itself was borrowed in the 1950s from the film, from the realm of psychoanalysis. The idea of identity is something that referred to innate characteristics, an outlook, a behaviour and so forth, was pioneered by Erik Erikson, who popularised its modern usage in his 1950 book, Childhood and Society. Now, Erikson wasn't really interested in national identities. He was interested in children and adolescents grasping for a sense of themselves in relation to the world around them. But what's interesting is that by the 1950s, this sense of the term identity is being borrowed from psychoanalysis, that's being built in to the civic discourse about collective identity. And it's in Canada and Australia that we've found that you see the very forefront of this development. And why is that? Well, it seems to be that the metaphorical use of identity to refer to a process of children and adolescents becoming adult seem to work for places like Canada and Australia that were seeking to wean themselves off the imperial embrace, trying to find a new purchase on their collective self in a post-British era. Harold Holt was the first Australian Prime Minister to use the term Australian identity or national identity in Australian context, and Bill Snedden was the first Minister to use the term in a Cabinet submission. This was in his time as Minister for Immigration, where he was referring to the need to take the word British off Australian passports. Why? Because our national identity is more apparent than it once had been. And in the way the term is used, what we've found is the defining feature of the language of identity, what distinguishes it from other forms of nomenclature, is the very palpable sense of uncertainty and disquiet that underpinned it. So it's no wonder that the quest for national identity has been seen ever since as inherently problematic, the subject of much rhetorical searching, questing, longing and striving and so on. But while all of this pondering and probing of the national identity was making headway in the 1960s, towards the end of that decade, other ideas about national self-definition begin to jostle for attention. And in a remarkably similar post-imperial context, responding to the same set of problems and dilemmas. In his elevated role as Governor-General, Paul Hasluck, took every opportunity to exhort his fellow Australians to embrace the idea of Australian patriotism. In one of his annual televised addresses as Governor-General, he announced, "Our patriotism has to be a patriotism for the Australia that exists, not to an Australia of a different kind that no longer exists." Now here, the long shadow of imperial patriotism needed no spelling out, but it lurked as the subtext of his every utterance, that Australians need to claim these things as their very own. But like the notion of identity, Hasluck's patriotism was couched in the future tense and had a grasping, even fumbling quality to it. Most tellingly of all, he declared, "Patriotism and loyalty are our own thing." It's about 1971. When you think about it, it's a really extraordinary thing to say to the Australian people. It's hard to conceive of a French president or an American president telling the people that our patriotism is ours, ours alone. And perhaps most interesting of all for our purposes, the idea of nationalism itself begins to make new headway in the late 1960s. And it was not Edward Gough Whitlam, but John Gorton, who was the first Australian Prime Minister, to run hard with this new language of nationalism. In 1968, he announced, "I hope you will join me in the years ahead to foster a feeling of real nationalism." Now, by invoking this rather unusual concept of real nationalism, Gorton ushered in the era of the redundant adjective. Real nationalism, distinctively Australian, uniquely Australian, truly Australian, proudly Australian. All of these extraordinary adjectives which would need no spelling out in many other national contexts around the world, but which are endemic in Australia because of this peculiar post-imperial tension that infuses our language. Gorton embodied the problem of disentangling Australia from wider networks of British belonging, particularly when he described himself on one occasion as "Australian to my boot heels," clearly seeking to distance himself from the now dubious taint of Robert Menzies' British bootstraps. So all this talk of nationalism was picked up by the press. Donald Horne commenting on Gorton's political style, dubbed it the New Nationalism. The New Nationalism referred implicitly to this business of extracting Australian civic culture from the sinews of empire. It was precisely this that was new about the New Nationalism. The term was widely embraced in Australia in the late 1960s and 1970s. It was used by Donald Horne, by Robert Drew, Manning Clark, Geoffrey Searle, Miriam Dixon, and became particularly associated with the prime ministership of Gough Whitlam. And it captured a mood, the youthful exuberance of the Vietnam protest movement, the boom in book publishing in Australia, the resurrection of the dormant Australian film industry, the Nobel Prize to Patrick White was somehow understood within this context, new theatre companies, and the iron ore nationalism that was associated with the minerals boom and Rex Connor in particular. But the underlying logic and cohesion of this catch-all phrase, new nationalism, remained hazy and confused, particularly in its political manifestations, in the kinds of politics, policies and projects that it underpinned. And I'll conclude by saying just three points in general about the new nationalism and then hand you over to James. Firstly, what we're arguing in the book is that the new nationalism was not what it purported to be, a spontaneous feeling arising out of the bosom of the people claiming their birthright, but a reaction to events unfolding elsewhere, events that tended to rob Australians of any meaningful purchase on the civic culture of being British. Secondly, the new nationalism was neither as robust nor as self-assured as it is, as it sometimes seems in retrospect, and certainly as it is sometimes fondly remembered. We document in the book the many opponents of the new nationalism. There were many, many people who were deeply against this kind of logic and this kind of direction for Australia. And interestingly, even the chief advocates of the new nationalism, from Donald Horne to Gough Whitlam, were torn on the question of nationalism itself, were vexed by the compromised history of nationalism, with two world wars and a Holocaust behind it. And thirdly, the new nationalism tended to falter when it came to devising viable solutions. The consensus around the need for something new tended to break down into internal squabbling and discord when it came to putting these ideas into practice, agreeing on alternatives. As such, it ultimately failed by its own standards as something that would provide a logic for a self-sufficient national myth and a guide to action and a guide to policy. And it's on this note, on the new nationalism in action, that I hand you over to James Curran.
Thanks, Stuart. Thanks, Gerard. Now, the problem of finding a new set of civic rights and rituals in the wake of empire, of remodelling the national image, was manifest across a broad range of practices and policies. In the decision taken in 1967 to mount an Australian pavilion at an international expo, the first time that Australia had done so, that was Expo 67 in Montreal. In the efforts from the late 1960s to invest substantial government funding in the arts and culture, particularly film and television, as a means of projecting a new, more distinctively Australian image to the world beyond, in the search for a new national anthem, the introduction of a new system of Australian honours, and in the increased efforts to invest Australia Day with a greater degree of gravitas. All of these are documented extensively in the book, but with each of them a common dilemma emerged. These new rites and rituals were being invested with a weight and a significance that they simply could not bear. The lack of a self-sufficient mythological base, as well as the realities of new international circumstances, conspired to undermine any attempt at forging a newfound sense of the people. As Donald Horne put it at the time, how could people in a modern, industrialised 1960s affluent society be expected to fabricate something so alarmingly old-fashioned as national symbols? Now, the task of locating a new footing for Australia's post-imperial foreign policy was also manifest. But there's an important difference here. Australia had long been able to identify its own independent interests in world affairs and to express its disagreement with its great and powerful friends, where it felt that it was not being treated as an equal, or if it felt that it wasn't being adequately consulted in the making of policies which directly affected Australian interests. This expression of Australian nationalism as a community of interest had a much more robust tradition in Australia than did the habit of scratching around frantically for a new set of national symbols. And the history of Australia's foreign relations is replete with examples of where the nation's particular geopolitical interests and anxieties brought it into sharp conflict with those of Britain and the United States. Yet despite this tradition, there were still problems in articulating a new sense of nationalism in Australian foreign affairs in the late 1960s and early 1970s. It was one thing to designate Britain a foreign country, which John Gorton did in 1969, both in the car coming from Heathrow Airport to the Savoy Hotel with his High Commissioner, Alexander Downer Sr. He nearly gave Downer Sr. a heart attack when he said that. But he also said it quite pointedly to British Prime Minister Harold Wilson that the time has come to treat Britain as a foreign country. In other words, our relationship with you is exactly the same as how we would treat our relations with China, Japan, or the United States. But it was quite another to put this label foreign into practice. In short, the new nationalism could only provide hesitant and ambivalent guidance to the conduct of Australian foreign affairs. Now, it was in the realm of diplomacy that Australians were most immediately compelled to adapt to a post-imperial strategic and cultural inheritance. In this new era, they faced an uncertain future in which all their assumptions about the world and the capacity of great power protectors to provide for their security were proving to be illusory. The international system that had held sway since the end of World War II had undergone rapid and substantial change. Above all else, the British military retreat from Southeast Asia and the American decision to withdraw from the Asian mainland following their defeat in Vietnam invited deep reflections about Australia's future diplomatic orientation. Indeed, by 1971, the Defence Committee was concluding, and I quote, that Australia's two traditional political and military associations had overshadowed to some extent full regional appreciation of Australia's capacity to maintain an independent stand. In other words, the redefinition of these two relationships with Britain and America became something of a proving ground for the new nationalism. But it would raise as many questions as it answered. In debates over the new Australian passport, removing the words British subject off the Australian passport, in the continued frustration on Gorton's part at the immigration queues that were facing Australians at Heathrow, even in a quirky bureaucratic switch like transferring the responsibility for the administration of Australia House from the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet to the Department of External Affairs, brought all these problems to the surface. And it always proved far easier to nominate Britain a foreign country than it was to implement it in practice. Now, the most important dimension in facing up to these realities took the form of Gough Whitlam's determination to rid Australia of what he called the colonial relics. Before his departure for his first visit to London in April 1973, he told a British journalist that Australia's ties with the UK, for geographic, historic and commercial reasons, he said, were less formal and less institutional than they once were. The process of stripping away the formalities of the relationship, including its residual constitutional anachronisms, as Winston Whitlam put it, became something of a crusade for the Labour leader. Indeed, his two visits to Britain as Prime Minister were almost wholly concerned with the task of bringing the institutional dimension of the relationship into line with the economic, defence and foreign policy changes that had already taken place. And this is the key point. Whitlam, though the changes are somewhat more dramatic, always pays his respect to the changes that had taken place before he came to office. He's quite explicit about this. Whitlam wanted to abolish appeals to the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council from the Supreme Court of the States, amend the Royal Style and Titles Act so that the Queen would henceforth become Queen of Australia, omit the reference to the Queen in the Oath of Allegiance, and institute a new national anthem and a new system of Australian honours. All of these proposed changes were essentially designed to construct a new idea of Australian nationality based on Australian rather than British citizenship. From the very beginning, however, the British did not quite understand Whitlam's zeal. Where Whitlam saw natural, emblematic steps towards a more independent status for Australia, the British instead saw constitutional minutiae and what they called a selfish and narrowly nationalistic Australian perception of its new world role. The High Commissioner in Canberra at the time, the British High Commissioner Maurice James, speculated, he said, that Whitlam might have sprung the catch previously restraining the emergence of an Australian national identity or point of view. But after his first meeting with Whitlam, Maurice James thought that the Labor Prime Minister suffered what he called a presentational itch and, quote, the desire to appear as a dramatic innovator. Now, Whitlam, as I said, maintained that these changes were in no way directed against Britain. He said, and I quote, that they were solely intended to put our relationship on a more mature and contemporary basis and to reflect the development of a more independent Australian identity in the world. And he said, indeed, what the government was trying to do is to give formal recognition to what has already happened as the necessary foundation for a realistic and more mature foreign policy. He said that what Australia was seeking to do was no artificial convulsion of contrived nationalism. Now, Malcolm Fraser, although he reinstated God Save the Queen and brought back imperial honours, did not unpick significantly the Whitlam changes. There was no lurch back to Kipling-esque sentimentalism. Indeed, in his first dispatch to London upon becoming the new British High Commissioner to Australia, Donald Tebbutt in Canberra observed that, quote, for a man from the Menzies stable, Mr. Fraser is quite unemotional about the British-Australian relationship. And he lamented at the end of 1976, he said that Britain has not so far featured on Mr. Fraser's calling list, because, of course, Fraser goes to China and Japan first in June of 1976. And reflecting on the state of the relationship, Tebbutt conceded that while the cultural bonds will continue to be enjoyed and the spiritual affinities will endure, he said they would not automatically cut political ice. Now, the same sense of putting the relationship with the United States onto a foreign footing is also quite clear, both during the Gorton and especially during the Whitlam period. And in just making a few concluding remarks, I'll talk about some other aspects of this. I think there's every indication that Australians were slow to adjust to the idea of embracing Asia, that they were also slow to adjust to the idea of treating Britain and the United States as foreigners. This was clearly quite a wrench. Indeed, in a widely circulated memorandum of March 1974 that is widely circulated to all American diplomats in Asia and in Washington, the American Consul General in Sydney, Norman Hanna, observed that Australians, he said, were, quote, very noisy in advertising their newfound independent superiority. But, he said, underneath the noise, they don't yet really believe it. We can expect, therefore, he said, that there will continue to be much uncoordinated, even contradictory thrashing about, not only in government, but in opposition, in academia, and in business, before a distinctive Australian role in the world could be established. But one thing, however, was very clear for the Americans, and that was... Whoops, sorry, Jared. One thing was very clear for the Americans, and that was that where they once thought of their junior ally as kith and kin, they must, Hanna added, treat Australia as another foreign country. Friendly, he said, but foreign. Now, I think thrashing about might seem an unflattering description, but there is something to be said for the image of a disoriented people grasping in every direction for a firm foothold in a post-imperial world. Rendering the great powers foreign was fundamental to this process, and it was clearly more of a wrench for some than for others. Now, there were some who wanted to flaunt this new outlook in a more flamboyant fashion, literally. In July 1974, the Secretary of the Department of Foreign Affairs, Alan Renouf, proposed that Australian diplomats should wear a new diplomatic uniform when appearing at formal functions in Canberra and abroad. Renouf's foray into the world of haute couture was no mere flight of fancy. Prototypes were commissioned and fashion parades held, albeit for internal departmental consumption only. The suits were reported to be in the Mao Nehru style, single-breasted and with high choker collars that were embroidered with golden sprigs of wattle. They would be in navy blue for those serving at posts in colder climates and white for those in the tropics. Renouf's twofold justification for the proposal drew on familiar themes. First, that Australian diplomats had become pale imitations of the Americans and British on the world stage. Second, that Australian representatives should stand out from the envoys of other nations at official functions. The proposal was greeted, as you can imagine, with a shower of scorn and sarcasm. The Sydney Morning Herald likened it to the sartorial catastrophes that adorned Australian sporting teams abroad, and even editorialised, quote, that this phony, unnatural and thoroughly un-Australian fancy dress would arouse deep misgivings. The Herald did not dispute that diplomats should seek to stand out, But they would not do so by, they said, making sartorial asses of themselves, as if to say, look, I'm an Australian. Other commentators ran rife. The Bulletin's David McNichol thought the whole idea was wacko for Bonds of Bazza Renouf. And while he was sure that this idea would be rejected by the minister, he wondered what might come in its place. Would, he said, there be an instruction to ambassadors that they must greet arriving guests with cries of cooey, serve fried witchetty grubs as savouries at all receptions, and arrange didgeridoo recitals as standard embassy entertainment. In The Australian, another columnist took great pleasure in proposing his own style of dinky dye dressing for diplomats, replete with a barbecue apron covered in a witty remark motif. Funny things like, he said, the hostess with the mostess, and try my meatballs. The Renouf rig, as it came to be known, may have been swiftly laughed off the national stage, but its very appearance stemmed from the same nagging tension that plagued much of Australia's new national horizons, in which the desire to soothe a presentational itch vied with the pressing need to sketch out a more independent policy stance in the world. Renouf clearly desired that Australians be treated with equal respect on the world stage, taking the idea of a nation free from the apron strings of its great and powerful friends from the briefing paper to the studied gaze of the embassy circuit. But in the end, it was dismissed as ugly and synthetic. The prototype remained on show behind a glass display case in the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade until the new building was officially opened in 1997, and it hasn't been sighted since. Now, in closing, I just also just make the point very quickly that it's important to note that it's not only just British officials that are the only ones to express a certain hesitation at the whirlwind of policy at this time, especially coming from Whitlam. The changes were so sudden and implemented with such speed that they'd caused a few heads to spin. The first commemoration of Anzac Day, for example, under the new Labor government, prompted some broader reflections on the nature and extent of the suite of changes to Australia's world position. The Sydney Morning Herald detected in Whitlam's international policies not the welcome reveille of revived independence, but rather what it called the discordant tones of an uncertain trumpet. That was the headline in the editorial, the uncertain trumpet. And where once Anzac Day had been caused to celebrate the cooperation with great and powerful friends, rather it had now become, it said, the first time that the Australian nationalism forged on Gallipoli shows signs of being equated with isolationism by its latter-day interpreters in Canberra. We're at odds with Britain, we're estranged from the United States, upon which our federal ministers heap abuse and insults. He's referring to Clive Cameron and others describing the Nixon White House as maniacs over the Christmas bombings of December 72. And it went on to add to the sense of a world turned upside down, the only countries which our government seems concerned to conciliate and befriend other communist states of China, East Germany, North Vietnam and North Korea. Those electors, it said, who agreed that it was time for a change are getting it with a vengeance. There is, of course, nothing wrong with change in foreign policies, provided it is rational and considered. The trouble is that in the field of foreign relations, it appears too often to be change for change's sake. And one thing seems increasingly plain, the view from Labor's Pisgah is of a lonely and isolated land. So to finish off, this editorial tone, I think, laced with nostalgia for the simplicity of the past and suspicion of the new direction in Australian foreign policy. But it showed that against the self-confident decisiveness of Whitlam himself, there was a perception that the Labor leader was not only moving too fast, but into uncertain, uncharted and unfamiliar waters. Here was a diagnosis which suggested that far from transforming the country into an outward-looking and proudly independent nation, it was instead retreating into the sphere of self-satisfied indulgence, Labor's version of the promised land. 2 years later, the Herald repeated the dose, lamenting that the new nationalism was turning Australia away from old alliances. In those days of common cause and unquestioned purpose, it said, the acknowledgement of alliances and their obligations, of blood ties and a shared inheritance of values, seemed no derogation of national identity and independence. I think that Whitlam's goal should have generated so much fierce criticism and misunderstanding, both at home and abroad, and the fact that they invited the suspicion of brash indulgence suggests that the new nationalism was not the ideal rhetorical platform for Australia's new diplomatic posture. Thanks.
Many thanks to Stuart Ward and James Curran, and their book The Unknown Nation is out, and Janet Grundy's got some copies of it which I'm sure our authors would be happy to sign. So we come to questions and discussion. Just taking up your final point, there's a book out by Francis Wheen which sort of suggests that Britain and large parts of the Northern Hemisphere and the Western democracies went a bit mad in the 70s, and I think there's evidence of some of that in what your comments have been today. And I'll just give you two brief examples of how turning to Australian nationalism led, in a sense, to some very bizarre positioning. You take the Whitlam Labor government, recognise the Soviet occupation of the Baltic states in 1974-75, which we became under Gough Whitlam the only country in the Western world who effectively recognised the impact of the Nazi-Soviet pact. And then if you go forward 2 years to Malcolm Fraser, when the communist murderous dictator Mao Zedong died in September 1976, the parliament moved a condolence motion moved by the Prime Minister Malcolm Fraser, seconded by Gough Whitlam, which grieved with the Chinese on the death of their esteemed leader. I mean, these kind of madnesses seem somehow to reflect an emerging Australian nationalism, but how does those kind of instances fit in with your theory? As there's not much of an Australian nationalist about that stance. It's a kind of a new kind of fawning to communist dictatorships. Either James or Stuart can lead off.
Yeah, I think, Jared, madness is probably that's one way of putting it, but I think what we've tried to do in the book is rather than look back on these issues and these problems and cast judgment on the actions or the policy prerogatives of individual politicians, or for that matter individual political parties, we've tried to understand this problem in terms of the inherent dilemma, the intractable dilemma that these people were confronted with. Now, in the case of whether it be, you know, reorienting Australia towards Asia, which, as you say, ushers in a different kind of rhetorical style towards places like China, or whether it's a question of dealing with the Soviet Union, Australian policymakers are really cast into the realm of the unknown. One of the side effects, if you like, of the civic culture of being British is that this also ordered not only how you viewed the world, but how you determined what was friend and what was foe. So in the case of the 19th century, how did Australians know that when the French moved into the New Hebrides, that was something to feel fearful about? And when the Americans moved into Hawaii, that was something to feel faintly encouraged about. It was because of this idea of your own cultural and political inheritance, that you were British, and that helped you determine what to be afraid of and what you shouldn't be. When you get to the late 1960s, this really does start to break down. One of the reasons we end up with a Department of Defence in the early 1970s, hitherto we'd had the separate service departments, the Navy, the Air Force and so forth, all of whom had far more intimate links with their counterparts in Britain than they actually had among themselves, is because there is a perception that we need to actually think for ourselves about where we stand in the world and to whom we should adopt a posture of defiance and to whom we should be friendly towards. And so a Defence Department was needed because we needed to work this out. One of the newspapers at the time referred to Australia's defence dither, because we don't any longer know who or what we should be defending ourselves against. And when you think about it in those terms, and you think about it in terms of the novelty of the dilemma that these people faced, I think that helps us understand their actions in a way that, I mean, there's a logic to it, I suppose, that you're fumbling and feeling for the correct tone, the right note. And when I say there's a logic to it, I pose that as an alternative to writing it off as madness.
Okay, so there's Anne.
Well, for both of you, actually. I wonder if the failure of those who led us in those times, sure, to crack the nut of what we felt about ourselves as a nation wasn't just that they were the leaders and not the ordinary people. And Australia's problem seems to me, which seems to be sorting itself out with globalisation, funnily enough, now, that it's got to come from the heart of the people, what nationalism really means. Too much definition doesn't make for nationalism. David Malouf says we shouldn't talk about identity, we should talk about experience. That experience is what gels us and brings us together. So to what extent was this all, while it was good that we were having people tell us we were breaking away from old ties, to what extent was it being top down rather than bottom up?
Just talk to the microphone.
Yeah, sure. Look, there's no doubt that that it was predominantly associated with political leaders and intellectuals. And I think one of the problems that the policymakers did have was when they sought to craft solutions to this post-imperial dilemma, whether it was investing Australia Day with more gravitas or trying to create a new honours system or in the search for a national anthem, although that's a different example, part of the problem was that this was not something that was being led from the grassroots. This was not something in which there was a popular upsurge of sentiment demanding that these things be remodelled. But with the national anthem, on the other hand, I mean, this is a national competition that's held, called by the Prime Minister, Whitlam, in early 1973, and it gets thousands and thousands of entries. Most of it is pretty earnest, chest-thumping doggerel. But nevertheless, there is a sense in which more people are engaged in terms of trying to find a solution to these sorts of problems. So undoubtedly, it's driven from the top down. I think this is part of the problem with the new orthodox way of defining Australia at that time as well. I mean, there was a very quick transition to defining Australia as a multicultural community, and this struggled to gain a purchase on the emotions of the people, and has struggled ever since.
So there's a question there, and then here, and then here. Yeah, it's got to be quick. Okay. No need to stand up.
No, it's going to be quick. I'll just ask the leading one. That is, your engagement with neo-colonialism comes from a European viewpoint, right? They abandon their colonies, etc. I suggest you approach it. I'm not disagreeing with you, but I suggest you approach it from the Australian point of view, and that is, Australia is an empire. And I hope I don't have to spell out what I mean by that. Like, when you obliterate 500 cultures or nations, you're a fascist empire, and fascism has to be used.
Okay, there's a suggestion that Australia is not only an empire but a fascist empire. So, Stuart, you're the man.
Okay, since I spoke about rhetoric and language, let me just say that one of the interesting things about this problem of European empires breaking up and so forth is that it confronts Australia with precisely that problem on two counts. On the one hand, there's a growing awareness of the legacy of Indigenous dispossession and so forth, and it's really from this era that we can see the long tradition of Indigenous protest, which goes all the way back to the early 19th century, finally get some kind of purchase on white Australian political discourse. And you see that with the 1967 referendum, and you see that with the 1970 Cook bicentenary celebrations, which is a public relations damp squib, partly because what the media are interested in is what the Aborigines have to say about the logical upshot of Cook from their point of view. So yes, this opens up a whole set of questions. You have Bill Stanner with his Great Australian Silence, Boyer lectures and so forth. So there's no doubt that there is a dovetailing of these kinds of issues. And the other one is Papua New Guinea, that through the 1960s, as the logic of the Western European maritime empires rolling back becomes more and more apparent, the legacy of Australia having effectively a colonial mandate over New Guinea becomes something that Australian governments want to live down, whether the Papua New Guineans like it or not. And one of the reasons that Papua New Guinea is essentially rushed into an independence that many people, or peoples within Papua New Guinea, preferred not to have because they feared their own internal rivals far more so than they feared Australia, was there was this sense that Australia had to clean up its backyard in order to be able to present a cleaner, new national face to the front yard. And you hear all sorts of rhetoric in the 60s about the need to quickly pressure cook some Papua New Guinean nationalists. And this leads to a very, very special irony that I think is not repeated anywhere else on planet Earth. Australia is devising the new national symbols for New Guinea. They are drafting their flag and writing their national anthem. It's an army a major from Anagra Barracks in Brisbane who writes the New Guinean national anthem. At the same time, they're devising these same symbols for themselves. That's a double act that I don't think is repeated anywhere else.
Question here. Yeah.
Yes. Isn't
isn't it a case now that the average person in the street identifies their Australianism through sport, that it's become competitive, and that's how they associate Australianism, that's how they see the nation, through sport? It's competitive, it's separated from the European and the UK, and sure, that's the way they see themselves, and this is what moves it down to the person in the street, rather than the political level or the other legal levels.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's a good question. To what extent is sport the test of nationalism? I mean, this gets back to the idea of nationalism, I guess, and whether or not sporting rivalries and sporting loyalties constitute an idea of, that people have of themselves as a unique people. I would probably question the extent to which sport equals nationalism, because I'm not sure to what extent that sport brings forth a history of what has made Australia a nation. And despite all the colonial rivalries in cricket, the Bodyline series, these were never events which really forced Australians to cut the painter and run from the mother country, despite all the animosity that it generated. What I would say, though, in the national anthem issue, which I think you'd find very interesting on this, is that it is sport that is driving, in many ways, the compulsion to get this anthem anxiety sorted out. Malcolm Fraser, for example, in 1976, advocates taking Waltzing Matilda as the national song to Montreal. Now, this is after he's reinstituted God Save the Queen as Australia's national anthem, and says we need something distinctive to play at the Olympics. We don't want to be mixed up with the Poms or the New Zealanders when we win a gold medal, so we will take Waltzing Matilda. And there's a huge debate with the Olympic Federation and the sporting community. In the end, he carries the day with the support of Gough Whitlam. Of course, the only problem is no Australians win a gold medal in Montreal. but then in 1980, very briefly, in 1980, he flips again. He's saying, do you really want Australia's national song to be played as homage to Soviet tyranny? Because this is in the context of the rolling of Soviet tanks into Afghanistan. And so there it becomes negative. In 1984, Bob Hawke finally sorts out the anthem confusion by saying, this is it, we're having Advance Australia at the fair, we're going to cut the verses out which refer to Australia's British soul, and we need to do it before the Los Angeles Olympics. So it's really Olympic games that force Australians to eventually call the tune.
So Australia won gold medals in 1980. What did we play?
Well, Lisa Forward won a gold medal. And
Michelle Forward.
Michelle Forward. And they played Waltzing Matilda.
Yeah. But it was an unofficial gold medal.
Yeah. It had the...
Hang on, just a minute. There's a question here, but be brief.
The fact that Australian troops fought in Iraq and are fighting in Afghanistan seems to me that Australian nationalism reconciles with our security, the security that now comes from America, which previously came to the British Empire, but it also aligns with our cultural heritage of, you know, democracy coming from the British and American lines, and our language and nationalism somehow fits in very well with these processes.
Well, another good question. I think, again, I'm sorry to keep coming back to nationalism, but after all, it is the key theme of the book. You make an important point. I mean, nationalism does give people two very distinct but nevertheless quite linked needs. You know, there is the sense of political nationalism, and that's what I was talking about in terms of the community of interest, and there's also cultural nationalism in terms of having a shared sense of tradition or values or language, as you say, and in the Australian case, these are quite different from European-style nationalism. I mean, in Europe, those two factors in nationalism coincide. That is that, you know, the defence of the cultural nation is also the defence of the political nation. There's a symbiosis there, if you like. In Australia, it's quite different. That's what makes Australian nationalism so novel and so interesting, is because the two are frequently at odds. Despite the fervent cultural attachment to the sense of being British, it never meant that Australians could not independently identify their own particular interests in this part of the world, which arose out of particular geopolitical anxieties. And where those two came into clash and conflict, Australians more often than not opted for that sense of political nationalism over cultural nationalism. And they could tell the Americans and the British to, that they had a different view. Didn't always win, didn't always get what they wanted, and sometimes their assessment of those interests were flawed, but they were still independently assessed.
Okay, so we go go here, 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 and down, down the back. Gotta be quick. Yep. Yes.
Yeah, you focus heavily on this idea of Australian nationalism being a developmental idea and something that hasn't come completely to fruition. So if I could throw a curveball and say if Australia becomes an independent state, do you believe that that would have a profound effect on the way that we view ourselves in terms of national, our sense of nationalism? Will it come to a fruition, or will it...
Question is, if we became a republic, would it make any difference insofar as nationalism is concerned?
Yeah, because the question was phrased in terms of if we become an independent state. I believe Australia is an independent state. When did it become independent? Well, the High Court's been asked that question one or two times, and the finest jurists in the land are unable to answer it. So I don't think, curveball or otherwise, we're advancing our understanding of the problem if we couch it in those terms. And I think one of the problems with the Republican referendum in the 1990s is that the message was filtered to far too great an extent through this idea that there was some aspect of Australia's capacity to rely on its own devices that was at stake, because that just didn't resonate with people. That didn't resonate with the lived experience of ordinary folks, let alone the people who are actually running the country.
Yep. Well, hang on, he's next, and then you are. Okay.
Sorry. Yeah. You spoke about identifying similarities between us and Canada in terms of the notion of national identity. The Canadians have been successful to a degree in adopting a symbol that everyone in the world over knows as Canada, the flag, the maple leaf flag. Is our failure to, or inability, or the fact that we simply haven't changed our flag to something analogous to the maple leaf flag, if such a thing in fact will ever exist, is that signifying a reticence in the Australian people for prosecuting this search for a national identity, or how do you see it?
Yes, the Canadian presence looms large through the 60s and 70s. Whenever this symbol debate hots up, there's this tendency in Australia to point to Canada and say they've got it all worked out, why can't we? And in fact, when Donald Horne coined this phrase, the new nationalism, he was partly talking about Canada and the flag and so forth. What we don't realise in Australia is that if you follow Canadian debates on these exact same questions through the 60s and 70s, they are prone to say, why can't we have a robust nationalism like they have in Australia? These people know what they're about. Australians know who they are. We in Canada were always asking the question, and we have this problem of Quebec. Now, on the subject of the Canadian flag, what we don't realise is that that was one of the most bitter and divisive debates in Canadian history. It locked down the Canadian Parliament for about 5 months because of the filibuster of the Canadian opposition, the Conservatives, who hated the maple leaf. Here they saw a symbol that said nothing about Canada's past. It said nothing about Canadians as a people. It was a tree. It was a leaf. It was an inanimate object that was an embarrassment. As a flag. One of the other flag designs had a beaver chewing on a piece of wood. They were all sort of this grasping for something that would actually suggest Canada. When the flag went up the flagpole in January 1965, John Diefenbaker, the Canadian opposition leader, was in tears, and it was to his electoral advantage, he felt, to be publicly seen to be crying when the flag changed hands. The province of Ontario, the day after the Canadian flag goes up, invents a flag of its own, with the Union Jack in the corner. We get to a national anthem before the Canadians do. Whitlam does it in 1974. It takes the Canadians another 6 or 7 years. So it's sometimes a question of where the focus of the debate happened to be at any particular time. I would resist any suggestion that we were somehow behind the eight ball in the symbolism stakes as far as the Canadians were concerned. One of the things that Pearson in Canada in 64-65 had to deal with that was not the case in Australia was the emergent problem of Quebec, the quiet revolution as it was known, the renewed vigour of Quebec separatists, and that is really what fuelled Pearson. He had no great desire to design a new flag. He was himself a British liberal, very much, and he'd worked in the Canadian High Commission in London during the war, so he had all of those feelings, but it was in order to deal with this problem that he pushed that particular emblem through. And somehow it worked. Again, the Montreal Olympics, I think, has a lot to say about Canadians finally rallying around this flag because it was a very divisive symbol at the time.
We're getting to the end, so we've got a quick question here, then down the back. Yep.
My question was related to a new flag in the Republic, too, so I have to rephrase it a little bit. You two, having studied nationalism, would you push for a new flag and a republic. And how would you like to see Australia go about it?
I think they're talking about the past, not the future. But if you want to buy into those debates, you can.
Well, look,
but you don't have to.
One of the things we do make fairly clear, I think, in this book is that it's not a work of policy advocacy. We're not trying to write an appendix to the latest set of budget papers about how you might go about funding a new national image, whether that be through a flag or a republic. I suspect, though, for what it's worth, that once Australia does become a republic, that is when you'll have a real urgency generated about the flag. As to what that might be, look, I won't take a stab at that. I think the Republican issue is not being invested with any sense of urgency at the moment by any political leader, and so it's really off the boil.
Can I push down the back?
Racism and the White Australia policy, they've been very important strands in our national character right up until about 2000. Can you get a comment on that?
Thank you. Well, the White Australia policy was dismantled in incremental fashion from the mid-1950s through to the early 1970s. I mean, I think that's a fairly important fact, and it was done in response to a changing sphere in Asia. It was done against the background of the rise of Asian nationalism. There were diplomats in Canberra and also bureaucrats in the Department of Immigration. Matthew Jordan, the historian, has spoken a lot about this. Basically saw the new situation in Asia evolving, realised that Australia had a policy that would cause problems for its future engagement with the region, and step by step convinced the policymakers to change. So I think it's important to see this process as an incremental one that belongs to both sides of politics. Sure, Al Grasby could say, give me a shovel and I'll bury the White Australia policy, but I think many of the most important changes have been advocated well before then, and we talk a lot about basically the way in which the racial language of Britishness progressively disappeared from the language of leaders and the language of intellectuals. I mean, the intellectuals who are talking about this problem of new nationalism are nervously tiptoeing around the idea of nationalism itself because they know that it's been associated with these monolithic and aggressive tendencies, and they know that Australia has a problem with its White Australia legacy. Okay, so they are very conscious of this, but I would argue actually that it hasn't been something that has plagued Australia right through. I mean, you can argue that some of the reactions to the Vietnamese boats arriving in the late 1970s showed, I think, the limits of the new language of multiculturalism and the end of White Australia. You can see it in the debates in 1984, and you can see elements of it with Pauline Hanson and the debate over immigration during the Howard government, but it's not the recrudescence of White Australia. It's not the old racist cat being let out of the bag. I don't think that's happened. I think Australia has long since dispensed with those policies, and that has been an important part of finding a new post-imperial footing.
White Australia wasn't just Australian either. There was also white Canada and white US. It was an imperial.
Interjections from the floor. suggestion that white Australia wasn't common to Australia. There were white other places too. Okay, final question, Robert.
When exactly do you mark the end of empire? Was it the death of Queen Victoria, the fall of Singapore, the surrender of Hong Kong? And if the empire is over, why are the British hanging on to Falklands with its massive world?
Okay, that's a biggie. There is no particular date where you can zero in on and say this was the end of empire. What we say is that the fall of Singapore certainly wasn't enough, that the fall of Singapore created a certain tremor and a certain anxiety, but the aftermath of that episode witnesses a rallying around to the idea of empire and a determination on the part of the Curtin and Chifley governments to bolster it and to ensure that a situation like Singapore doesn't happen again. But what happens into the 1950s and 60s, we don't identify a particular moment or an issue or a date, but there are two processes that really come together in the early 1960s. And one is the global unravelling
of the British Empire in Africa from 1957 through to 63. And this is phenomenal what happens. In 1957, the British Colonial Office is estimating that for the most part, the African Empire will continue until at least the year 2000. Kenya won't be ready for independence until the 1990s. Ghana, Nigeria, I should say, well into the next century. And yet within 6 years, that has collapsed. And there are two things really going on. There's an ideological shift that sweeps across the Western world. The United Nations and the liberal internationalism of the 40s produces the logic of colonial national liberation, and it becomes the British government, particularly under Macmillan, gets to the point where the empire is no longer an asset but a liability. And once that is recognised, it's in the Macmillan government's interest to liquidate it as quickly as possible. And this has all sorts of consequences, and this brings me to the second process: what next for Britain? Macmillan also recognises that Britain has no future as an isolated, obscure, offshore European island, and that it's at this point that he begins to pursue membership of the EEC with great gusto. And it's, if you're looking at it from an Australian point of view, even though this is a very gradual and in some respects an imperceptible development, what are the issues that really bring the message home, that make Australians actually talk among themselves and make our newspapers and our media outlets actually recognise what's going on? It's Britain's turn to Europe in the early 60s. That symbolism of Britain abandoning its trade preferences and the economic advantages for the Commonwealth and saying, we're not going to do that anymore, we're going to enter a customs union with the same countries that you just helped us defeat in two world wars not very long ago. This is shocking. This is an insult. And interestingly, particularly in rural Australia, there are whole industries, there are whole regions that are dependent on the British market. This is before the minerals boom and Japan fully comes to our rescue. And goodness knows what Australia would look like today if those two elements had not emerged. Queensland, north of Rockhampton, the sugar industry, what was going to become of that part of the world with Britain turning elsewhere for its sugar needs and so forth. So it's really at this time that you start seeing, particularly at the level of the civil service and at the level of governance, that this begins to hit home. And interestingly enough, you start seeing all this talk emerges about what Australia might look like after Britain. So that's how I would answer that.
Many thanks. Head and seat. I'll be very brief, but it's great to think back to the 60s when we used to worry about the future of the Australian butter industry. So. And it's great to be reminded these debates about British withdrawal east of Suez were around a decade before the Whitlam government came to office. What's always impressed me about the work of James Curran and Stuart Ward is they're historians, intellectuals, but also people who are actually empiricists. They talk about facts and things that happen and interpret them. And I think that's a fine kind of history, and we saw it tonight. We're talking about great themes, but also themes that are explained with reference to events and happenings and people and time. So, well done tonight. Congratulations on The Unknown Nation. There are copies of it around, and I'm sure you'll be working on other projects, and you'll be back to the Sydney Institute sometime in the future. But for tonight, well done. Great work, and keep up the good work.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.